The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Katie Elfering. She is a senior design researcher for Microsoft. Prior to that, she did research and insight work for another obscure company by the name of Apple. In her job, Katie does insightful thinking about consumer behaviors, trends, and motivations with a specific focus on millennials and Generation Z. Katie, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so this past weekend, we had a bunch of friends over at our house, and I was in a group conversation when someone asked me who I was interviewing on the podcast this week. When I told them about you and that you had a particular focus in your work on millennials and Generation Z, to a man and woman, they all asked me this question in response: what is Generation Z?
Oh, it's a good question. You know, it's one of those weird definitions that's sort of coming into fruition. It's the generation coming up behind millennials, and nobody's really figured out totally what to name them. That's at least the name that I've heard most commonly used. But it is interesting because it's also kind of the laziest name. If you think of Gen X, and then millennials for a while were called Gen Y, and now they're calling them Gen Z, it's probably the easiest name. I don't know how accurate it's going to actually be. Because we did see millennials kind of take over the whole Gen Y moniker. But it is interesting. That's kind of that next up-and-coming group.
Yeah, so I actually Googled it, and I saw a writer say that Generation Z is, quote, the least likely to believe there is such a thing as the American dream. And this was because their Gen X parents didn't subscribe to that vision like the baby boomers did, which I guess is, like, my fault.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure, if you want to take that on. But I do think it's interesting because it's this, you know, there's been all this talk, especially lately, of generational studies and are they accurate or relevant? And I've read a lot lately on do generations even exist? And I think, yes, they do, because it's impossible to say that people aren't shaped by their, you know, sort of time coming of age out in the world. And especially that sort of coming of age time is when you really see these generations start to form. But also there's other influences, not just what's going on around you, it's who parents you. So for Gen Z, they mostly have Gen X parents. And that in and of itself has a huge amount of influence on them. So those attitudes that are sort of stereotypically ascribed to Gen X are definitely having an impact. Now, whether or not that means that, you know, they don't subscribe to the American dream or that they're not that optimistic, I don't know if we can say that yet, in large part just because still a generation that's forming. But I do think it is interesting to think about where all of those points of influence come from. And especially, you know, for younger people who are kind of coming of age, what's going to impact them most moving forward? Is it parenting style? Is it society? Is it culture? Is it politics? Is it the economy? All of those things have a pretty big impact.
Yeah, and one of the things that I found interesting when I was doing a little digging into this was I think we tend to lump millennials and this sort of Generation Z into the same bag when we talk about social media, but they're different because the Generation Z kids don't remember a time before social media. And I know this difference with I have an 18-year-old and a 14-year-old, and the 18-year-old is on Facebook, and the 14-year-old, while she's on there, it's not as much. And one thing I saw is that the Generation Z kids, they've embraced anonymous social media platforms like Snapchat, Whisper, and Secret. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think a lot of people, especially when we talk about millennial generation, one, a lot of people forget how old millennials actually are. You know, the oldest millennials are in their mid-30s. And when you think about their access to social media, to technology in general, people call them digital natives all the time, but in reality, I mean, I'm technically on that older cusp of that older end of millennials. I had a VCR in my house. I think I still have one in my house. You know, I still watch linear TV, even though I stream a lot of things too. I'm on a lot of social media. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Snapchat. But I have a very different relationship to it because it was coming of age with me, and I was discovering it as it was being sort of born into society. Whereas, you know, people who are in Generation Z, whether they're kids or teenagers today, they have a very different relationship because this has already existed for them. They're not coming into a world where this is just starting out. This is well established, or at least in its adolescence at this point. So for them, you know, like, the idea of Snapchat, the idea of sort of ephemerality, which is fascinating to look at in social media, makes a lot more sense because they haven't really developed their full identity yet. They don't really need to have an entire profile because they're still figuring that out. Instead, so they can have a whole bunch of them, and they can change them and delete them and have them sort of exist temporarily because that's the life stage they're at, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and would you subscribe to the idea that the Generation Z group is less risk adverse, especially growing up in sort of a post 9/11, and you know they lived through the Great Recession, that also those anonymous platforms allow you a little bit more protection?
Totally. I think millennials, for that matter, are too, especially the younger end of millennials. You see way less risk aversion, or you see way less risk taking.
Yeah.
You see this idea of, you know, I want to be smart with my money, so I'm going to live at home with my parents instead of paying rent somewhere because I want to be able to save for my future. And that sounds super responsible for a generation that does not often get that word used when you talk about them. And I think Gen Z is the same way, this attitude of, I don't want to risk my future by putting something out on social media that might hurt me in a job interview down the line, so I'm going to use something that's more ephemeral. And then at the same time, I think you see them being a little bit more flexible and free. And there was a big trend a couple of years ago on Instagram where we were seeing teenage girls posting what they were calling uglies instead of selfies. And it was these goofy, it was right before Snapchat really took off, and it was these sort of goofy, not the best, not sort of perfected, not the right angle, don't have the best makeup. But it was this way of being able to say, you know, this is who I really am. And there was that layer of authenticity. And I think a lot of the social media that's out there now and the apps that are allowing them now give them that sense, too. I don't have to be perfect all the time. I can take a really ugly picture on Snapchat or something that's really ridiculous that doesn't need to live in a profile forever. And I can send it to someone, and it contributes to my identity, but it doesn't have to define me. And I think that's a big piece of that, too. And it goes back to that risk idea.
Yeah, I love that. And I love, in general, and this is the thing I want to dig in with you, because I feel like we have these broad strokes ideas about millennials. And in your research and writing that I've read, there's far more nuance. And one quote I saw you had, which is, you said, while it's true that millennials take more selfies than other generations, labeling them the selfie generation seems to miss the mark.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is true of just all sort of generational studies, but I think, you know, while there is merit and weight to the idea of generations, to say that all millennials are something or all Gen Xers are this, or all boomers are this, I think it makes it really easy. And I think it helps, especially in marketing and advertising, to say, oh, they're all like this, we know what we're doing, and it gives us direction, and it's really easy to figure out how to get a message to them. But I think oftentimes you're just going for that really kind of lazy middle when you do that. And especially when you look at the millennial generation, which has been written about and talked about to the point where even when I say the word, it feels like overkill.
Right.
It's missing the mark on so many levels, because often what we're talking about is this sort of white-ish, maybe slightly diverse middle-class group of this generation. And we're ignoring the fringes, we're ignoring the edges, and we're ignoring the nuance. And I think that, to me, saying, you know, oh, they're the selfie generation, because yes, selfies are a thing that people do, sure, that's fine, but it's not accurate, and it's really it's limiting the opportunity to really get to know these people. And I think that's where, especially a lot of the research that I've done in my career, it's really about trying to go a lot deeper and trying to avoid things like really boring, really static personas or stereotypes, and instead saying, how can we actually find the core truths that matter independent of some of these stereotypes, and then understand why some of these stereotypes exist or why some of these behaviors are happening.
Question for you. Is this a generation, the millennial generation? I've read it that they're a generation that has more choices. There's more robust choices for them. Is that true?
I mean, I think it is to a certain extent just because of technology. You know, mm-hmm. I remember, again, kind of being on the cusp of that. I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota. It took a really long time for trends and things to hit there. I would be sitting in my, you know, suburban house reading my Staffy magazine, getting really excited about blue nail polish or Urban Decay makeup or all of these different things. And I couldn't get them because there was nowhere to buy them because right. they just didn't exist where I lived. Now I just go on Sephora and I do it on my mobile phone or I do it on my computer or I do it a variety of different ways. And I not only have access to those brands, but literally every brand. I think it's a generation from a retail perspective, especially, that has more. I mean, everyone has all these choices. Let's not pretend that everyone doesn't have these choices. But they've come of age in a world where these choices exist. And not only just for brands and buying things, but for their life decisions. You don't have to get married before you have a kid. You don't have to go to college to get a good job, theoretically. You don't have to follow these set paths because there are more players out there who've done them for you, and also just more options than I think people have ever really taken advantage of before. And again, all patients have, in large part, had a lot of these, at least in the present moment, if not, you know, even in the past. But it's a generation that is so aware of them and takes advantage of them, I think, so much more because they came of age as it was at a time when it was easier for them to do that.
Yeah. And this makes me think of two things. One thing I think of is sort of Richard Thaler's work in choice architecture, this idea that we have a responsibility to help people make sort of better choices for themselves. And we can do so if we apply our thinking in a way to understand that the way things are framed for people affects their choices. So, you know, it's as simple as, you know, having people have to opt out of healthcare rather than opt in. And the numbers are very skewed when it goes either way. And the second thing I think about is in the improvisational work that we do, so much of it is around exercises and games with a new choice and a different choice rapidly. And I feel like there's something interesting inside that sort of architectural relationship and sort of skills building for a generation that's being presented with just, you know, all these choices that are literally at their fingertips that move so quickly, faster than ever before.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that people don't talk about enough when we talk about just people in general today, but also especially these younger consumers, millennials, Gen Z, all of them, is how overwhelming all this choice can be and how sort of paralyzing. And I love that idea of, you know, helping people to make better choices through that framing. If you can opt out of something instead of opting in, or the reverse, depending on what it might be. But I think that that's one of the big things that's been challenging for this generation is just they have so many choices. And I think we've seen, especially with millennials, and I think probably going to see it with Gen Z too, this unwillingness to settle because there are so many choices that it's really hard to just decide on something in case there might be something else around the bend, or to settle for something that might be just pay, that kind of just curse word that comes in for this generation. They don't want it to be just fine or just mm-hmm. okay or just because. They want there to be intent and purpose, but that requires a lot of energy and effort, and it can be super stressful and very overwhelming. I think even in improv, you see this sense of wanting to sort of perfect it a little bit, which is really challenging. I mean, in improv work that I've played with in different professional training settings, my instinct is to wait until I have the perfect thing. That goes against that sort of in the moment, just do it now, yes and mindset.
Yeah. I think in improvisation, we accept that the mess exists and you try to, you know, fail fast and fail in context so you can then get to the thing. You also have mentioned, you talked about that generation having an intimacy with speed. How does that play itself out?
I mean, we live in a world where, you know, Uber can be at your house in 2 minutes. It's pretty amazing.
Yep.
The sense of just expectation that things will work and that they will work quickly and they will work at a high quality. And you can blame or credit a lot of brands and a lot of products and a lot of startups for that. But the idea that this intimacy of speed that I think we see, especially, I mean, I think we see it across generations. I think it's not just a millennial thing, but I think there is this sense of, I don't really want to have to settle, and part of settling is not wasting time. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that they're not, you know, willing to take time and to put in time and energy, but I think there has to be a reason why. And that's a big thing. I think, you know, I've joked in the past when we talked about meals that that name took over for Gen Y, but it really should have been Gen WHY because there's so much questioning of everything with this generation. Why are we doing this? Why does this take so long? Why doesn't this take longer? And I think that that intimacy of speed plays into that, the expectation of things should work and they should be fast and they should be high quality and they should all sort of come together in kind of this perfect storm. And when that expectation isn't met by anyone, it's really aggravating. And again, I think other generations have some of this mindset, but I think because of the world that millennials came of age in when they were really in those formative years, and that Gen Z, frankly, is coming of age in those same years, it's just an expectation. It's not a new thing or a nice to have. It is their actual reality as opposed to something they're having to learn.
So this makes me wonder why we're still dealing with chip card readers. So I don't know if you've had this experience, but it completely bugs me now that so many of our credit cards contain these chips, and across the board, whether I'm getting money out of an ATM or if I'm paying for goods at a grocery store or I'm at a Target, the transaction is considerably longer and slower than when it was when I would just swipe my credit card.
I know, it's worse, right? I hate it too. I've seen more internet memes. If you just search for really funny either videos around it or cartoons and things all over the internet now, because it is super frustrating. And theoretically, it's supposed to be this more secure, easier to use option. In reality, it's become the opposite of that. And it's really, really frustrating.
Yeah.
But I think that that's, again, where you see, I think you've seen this with a lot of technology that's come out, things like QR codes, which had a lot of promise when they launched. And it was this big idea that we can scan barcodes everywhere and do all these really cool things. And then most of them didn't take you anywhere, or
right.
They didn't add to your experience. They were interrupted more than anything because they made it harder or they didn't meet your expectations. They weren't additive. I think that's the big thing I've always said when I've talked about not just millennials, but just consumers in general today, people in general today. I think especially for brands and marketers, even people developing products or creating experiences, whatever you're doing has to be additive. It has to make their life better or faster or stronger, which sounds like a Kanye West lyric. But but the idea that you're making life, you're adding something that they couldn't have done without this experience or product or service instead of interrupting. And I think chip card readers are a perfect example of how it's become interruptive. And it's interrupting something that really, I mean, from a security perspective, yes, we need to get better, but it really didn't need to be interrupted in this way. This isn't the best way to disrupt the payment system.
Yeah, right. It's so annoying. And then conversely, Caitlin, who's one of my colleagues and friends who works in our office, and she's a millennial, she came in, she just moved apartments, and she used Dolly. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. And it's basically an Uber moving service. And I was like, that's crazy. And she told me what she paid and was like, nothing. And she said it was fantastic, that service. And so this whole, you know, and this is so alien to me. I just turned 50 this last weekend, and I like to own my things. I like my books. I like my records. And everyone's like, are you not on Spotify? And I'm like, well, I'm on Pandora a bit, but, you know, I like to have my music. And this whole orientation around the Uber economy where people no longer care to own things because they still have access and use, and that access and use is actually fantastic across the board.
It is. I mean, and I think that's definitely, it's a really amazing thing that I think this generation has very much owned and taken advantage of in a lot of ways. But I also think it's a little bit dangerous because I think there's some places where you don't really need to own things. I think Dolly is one of those amazing services. Uber is another one. I know here in Seattle, where I just moved, we have a really great, we have a lot of really great car sharing services, which I know are all over. But we have one sponsored by BMW where you get to drive BMWs around, just
sweet.
Like a zip car. Like, that's really cool, and it makes me not have to have a car, which is really, really exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the flip side is, you know, there are some things that at a certain point we are going to pay for. We could have a huge conversation about arts and entertainment and journalism and,
right.
and content as something that at a certain point someone's not paying for it. How does it get created? And I think you're starting to see a little bit of that tension. I mean, it's been around for a really long time, but I think you're starting to see a little bit of that with this generation. But I also think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, attitude of, if it's worth it, I'm going to put in the energy and effort to do it. And that oftentimes means paying for it. You can see that in the rise in vinyl among
yeah.
younger consumers and the idea that there is a value there that is worth paying for. You see it in attitude towards food. You know, I want to buy better food. I want to buy things that I know are better for me. Whatever that better is, may not, you know, it may just be the best potato chips out there. But it's that idea of, I want to put my time and energy and money into things that actually matter to me personally, and then hopefully to that sort of larger we, so that it's kind of good for the world or the planet or the community or whatever. But I think there's this sense of, you know, if I don't have to own it and it doesn't benefit me to own it, why would I? And if I do own it, why is it important for me to own it? And why does that make a really big difference? And I think every category right now is being impacted by that attitude.
You know, with the kind of work you do, I had assumed you had studied data research or some branch of clinical psychology. But no, you were an English major at the University of Minnesota.
I know there's that song in Avenue Q about what can you do with being in English. And I think my parents had that as their ringtone when I called them from college. I was an English major, a journalism major. In fact, my degree actually says print journalism on it.
So, all right.
It's super useful right now. But it's interesting because I think what both of those sort of study areas led me to was just this sense of research. And I think, you know, if I go back to school someday, I'll probably get a degree in anthropology or some sort of comparative studies, because I think, you know, the idea of just understanding not only what people do, but why they do it is so important. And whether you're working in marketing and advertising, which I did for a really long time, whether you're working on more of the corporate side and doing more product development design, which is what I'm doing now, you know, it still comes back to this basic idea of why do people do what they do? That's what journalists ask all the time. That's what great writers always tried to figure out in their novels, was, you know, why do people do what they do and what does that actually mean? And I think, you know, for me, I try to take it a step farther and say, and then what do we do with that to make their lives better through marketing or advertising or product development or whatever that might be? But yeah, I mean, English degree does not, I'm the only one that I know in my office right now that has one.
You have a great quote. You said engagement starts with the story, not the platform. And I think this idea of how important storytelling is, not only to make messages sticky, but to understand the characters and the POV that's out there. I think that's where that, you know, reading all those books makes a difference when you're an adult.
Yeah, I mean, I think it totally does. I mean, people have used the word storytelling a lot as a buzzword lately, but I think it's still so important to remember the whole point of what storytelling is, which is to tell a great story that is engaging and entertaining and maybe informative, but that catches people's attention and makes them pay attention. And I think, you know, whether you're in marketing or research, where I feel like we're doing more and more storytelling every day, it's just this sense of, if you can understand the motivations and if you can understand the goals people have, if you can understand, you know, what really truly drives them and makes them tick, then you can help to tell their story and see where that narrative comes from. And whether you're doing it from a research perspective or whether you're doing it from a marketing perspective to craft some sort of brand message, it's so important to understand. And for me, that's where my background came from. I read a lot. In fact, I'm looking at my computer screen right now, and I have 50 tabs open in one browser window and another browser that's minimized. And I think it's really important to stay, you know, aware of what's happening, but also to hear those voices all the time.
Yeah, speaking of education, too, one of the defining characteristics of both millennials and Gen Z is their attitude towards higher education. So there's this concern around assuming all that student debt. Are you listening to Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History podcast?
I have listened to a few episodes, yeah.
The one that I love, I think it's episode 6, is where Gladwell is just infuriated by Phil Nike's $500 million endowment that he gives to Stanford so they can build out a new leadership initiative for like 100 of the best students. And Gladwell's point is that Stanford already has an endowment of $22 billion, and that money would have been much better spent going to give better education to hundreds of thousands of students rather than just 100.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting topic. We could have a whole separate conversation just on it, because I think, again, it goes back to this idea of what is it worth? Especially looking at a younger generation who's looking at the world around them, and, you know, especially when you look at those younger millennials who came out of school in the recession. A lot of older millennials were already out of college when the recession hit, so they were the ones really impacted by the layoffs and the, you know, sort of last hired, first fired attitude. Younger millennials were coming out of college into that job market. I watched my younger sister struggle with student loan debt, struggle to find a job, struggle to even think that she was going to be able to have steady work because, you know, she had a degree in the liberal arts and it was a really challenging time. And I think you have a generation even younger coming out of this now that's looking at that and saying, is this worth it? Is the time, is the energy, is the money, is all of this worth it? Or is there another path that I can take? And I think you're seeing more and more of those paths be opened up, because I think they've always existed. It's just more the awareness and the sort of acceptance of that. And that's where it gets really challenging, because especially with higher education, for so many companies, a college degree still is a requirement. Yeah. And that is really, really tricky when you have the people making the hiring decisions expecting one thing, and a generation or two generations of younger consumers coming into that market saying, but I think we could do it a little bit different. I'd like to challenge your expectation. And that tension, I think, is going to be fascinating to study for a very long time. But also, I think it's going to have a really big impact on things like entrepreneurship and startups, because those, back to our conversation about risk aversion, those are really risky propositions. So if you don't go that sort of quote-unquote traditional way through education, how much risk are you willing to take on to try something else? And so there's tons of facets to this, but it also just is back to that big question that I think both of these generations ask all the time. Is this really worth it, time, money, energy-wise?
I'll note for you, too, just so you feel like you're in good company, that we had on Michael Slaby, who is Obama's chief technology officer for both of his campaigns. He was an English major as well.
Oh, that makes things better.
Yeah. And we had that conversation, right, about the ability to, and it wasn't just stories. It's an orientation towards dreaming a little bit and seeing what's not there and having comfort with maybe putting something out there that's completely original. And, you know, from our work, what we understand about improvisation is all originality comes from discomfort. That indeed, it's that not knowing what comes next that is the place where all great ideas, you know, live. So yes, throw it out there. It might not work, but it might. And that's not an orientation. Going back to education, I don't think that's an orientation that a lot of schools support.
At least they didn't used to. I think you're starting to see more and more of that. But that, you know, you mentioned fail faster here, and I think that you're starting to see more of that, not just in school, but in companies.
Yeah.
And I think you're seeing more of that with the way that especially really, really smart companies are hiring around young people, where they're hiring people who may not totally have the skill set that they need, but they know they can teach them that. And instead, they hire for someone that has drive and ambition and really wants to put in the energy and work to learn those skills. And so I think you're starting to see a little bit more of that, both in the actual sort of academic side and in the corporate or in the sort of hiring side. But I do think it's really interesting how that's going to progress, because there has to be a break point, just from tuition costs and things like that, but there also has to be a breaking point kind of societally, where we say, is this the accepted path, or are there enough alternatives that we're really, really willing to say are valid and worth it?
Yeah. I can't believe we come to we're already here at the end of our half hour. Katie,
how did that happen?
I know. It's like this every week, because we get good guests. We talk to really interesting people, and you're one of them. So listen, we always end this podcast this way. We ask our guest to give us a yes and story, a time in their life or work where they could have said no, but they said yes and what happened? Do you have one of those for us?
I do. I don't know if it's like my Midwestern background or what. There's that sort of Minnesota night thing. But I was at a transition point in my career probably 3 or 4 years ago. I loved what I was doing. I worked on the vendor side. It was really, really fun. I loved my coworkers, and I was doing really exciting work. But I just felt like I needed to start thinking about what I was going to do next. And I was actually at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And a person who was at the time a client, but had become a friend and a mentor, said, you know, hey, we should get a drink before this event tonight that we were all planning to go to. And I said, oh, you know, and I don't know, again, maybe it was just that sort of Midwestern passive thing of just wanting to say, like, no, that's okay. Because I didn't really know her very well. I worked with her, but we weren't super close at the time. And instead I said, okay, that sounds great. And as I went back to my hotel to get ready, I just started thinking, like, she might be someone who could actually help me. Maybe I could bring this up over drinks. And of course, what happens in Vegas is that cab lines take forever. If you've ever been to CES, you know that it's worse than you could ever imagine. And I was an hour and a half late for these drinks. And I felt terrible. And I was texting her saying, like, if you want to bail, that's totally fine. You have to stay. Kind of like the opposite of yes and at that point.
Yep.
But she waited, and I sat down. I bought her a bourbon. I bought myself a bourbon. And I said, you know, I'm so happy you suggested this. Also, I would really like to pick your brain about my career. And that felt really bold for me. It felt very out of character to kind of be, in my mind, selfish. But it was that moment of, I didn't just say yes to the drinks. I said yes, and I'd really like to make something out of it. And she ended up being the person who hired me at Apple and became my boss and a very, very good friend. And if I hadn't done that, if I hadn't, you know, not only accepted the drinks and then apologized profusely for being late and paid for the drinks, if I hadn't done that, I don't think I would be where I'm at now, and I wouldn't be doing the type of really interesting work I'm doing.
That's so true. I have the exact same kind of conversation, frankly, on a weekly basis, where I am ready to say no because I'd rather just go home and, you know, decompress. But I say yes, and remarkable things happen. I love
that.
Yeah,
I had my sweatpants on. I was ready to stay in. I was done. But I thought, you know, I'm going to push myself a little bit, and thankfully it worked out. So
that's great.
There you go,
Katie. Thanks for coming on to Getting Yes And.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, folks, Katie's got this little company she works for, Microsoft. You might want to buy some of their products. It might do something, you know, well for her. So I encourage you to do so. And we'll see you next week on Getting the Yes And. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.